You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science this week, we are joined once again by our expert, Dr. Kushla McGovern. Good afternoon.
Kia ora.
How's your day going thus far?
Oh, not too bad.
That's good. Yeah. And we've got lots of science today, as always. Lots of interesting stories and a little bit silly, the first one at least, from the headline.
Yeah, no, this is really cool. So we've talked about fluorescence before on Dear Science, and this is where if one wavelength of light or one colour of light is shined at something and then it glows or it emits a different colour. Mm. So previously we talked about it, one of the examples was scorpions,
yes,
where if you put, yep, UV light on them, they look blue-green.
Mm.
And so it turns out that the Mexican free-tailed bat has fluorescent toes.
Yeah, what's going on there? Yeah.
So I'll start off with, we have no idea why this is, but it's really cool kind of the way that they discovered this. So these bats are actually known for having these really hairy toes. So if you check it out, a picture online, it's quite cool. And these hairs are also really, they're bizarre anyway in that they're spoon-shaped bristles.
Right.
And so they've always been known to be a bit bizarre, but no one ever thought about looking at them for fluorescence.
Yeah.
And how this team in Mexico actually discovered this was they were interested in these bats to know whether they were flying between two sites near Mexico City, I believe it was. And so what they did is one night they went to one site and they used what are called mist nets. And these are these really fine nets that you use to catch birds and bats and flying sort of animals in a way that's not going to cause them damage. So, you know, like ecologists and conservationists use these things, they get the bird or the bat, and then often they'll tag or they'll do weight measurements and stuff, and it's to gain information about the population.
Yeah.
But what these scientists did was they actually dusted the bats with this powder that was fluorescent. So if they shone UV light, or also known as a black light, at the bats, they would see that they fluoresced. And so then the next night, they went 20 to 30 k's north to this other site where they thought these bats were also flying to, and they took out their little black light torches and they're having a walk around looking for their dusty bats.
Yep.
And there were none. It totally failed.
Right.
But one of the researchers went, is that normal? Do their feet normally look like that?
Yeah, right.
And so they started looking at their feet, and lo and behold, like these toes, these bristles were glowing. And so, they're like, oh, wow, is this just in this area or is this like these bats in general? So they looked at 25 bats across these two sites. And then they also, someone managed to catch a female, one of these Mexican free-tailed bats, like 700 k's away. And they all had these glowing toes. And so now we know, we can add the Mexican free-tailed bat to the likes of the, platypus, tardigrades, flying squirrels, the scorpions, all these sort of fluorescent animals.
Right, yeah.
But we have no idea yet why.
Absolutely no clue.
And, yeah.
What an incredible discovery, right, to just find that by accident completely. Yeah.
And to have the presence of mind to go, oh, that's a bit strange, like, and I keep seeing it, and let's look at it.
Let's investigate that a bit in depth. I don't suppose, are there other like natural substances they could have had on their feet that would have been?
So they did, that was part of them looking at the different, you know, because was it just the dust that had collected in these bristles? And so that's why they were very careful to look at multiple populations. Yep. The other thing that they did that was quite interesting was they went and looked at specimens that have been preserved in museums. And what actually they found there was the toes weren't glowing, but the whole body glows like this, like green. But that's probably because of the preservation chemicals used. And so this is one of the challenges of natural history specimens in museums is actually what color fastness and like how these compounds survive with preservation and time and stuff.
Interesting stuff there. And then second here, we've got glue inside the body. Bit of a scary or a strange image, at least.
Yeah, no, it is, right? But it's you think about, you know, you get surgery, they make these incisions, and we think, okay, you stitch them up.
Yep.
And so you can get, you know, there's the stitches that have to be taken out, or you can get the dissolvable stitches. Yep. But kind of it would be really great if you could just have like an adhesive patch or a bit of glue, right?
Yeah.
And actually, there are medical adhesives. So, like, if you have external sort of injuries, they might use an adhesive. And it's basically what's called a cyanoacrylate, which is super glue.
Right.
Right. But you can't use that internally in the body because it's cytotoxic, so mildly cytotoxic. So it kind of kills the cells around, which is not great if you're trying to heal.
Yeah, not ideal.
It's also a bit brittle, so it'll break and it's slow to decompose. So there is quite an interest in having something that you could have internally that kind of holds, you know, sutures together. It makes life a bit more easy.
A bit of a bio glue.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly right. And so what this team have done is they actually, it's really interesting where they've taken what's a polymer that's been known for a long time but thought was useless, basically. And so it's this, there's this, so polymers are just a collection of monomers. Like, it's just a chain of molecules that are bound together kind of thing. And so there's this molecule called alpha lipoic acid, and it's found in lots of plants and animals and things like red meat and spinach and tomatoes. And what it does is it has a ring in this molecule, and that will break open. And when it breaks open, it can bind to others like itself that have also broken open. And it forms a polymer. But this polymer spontaneously breaks down. Like, it's really unstable. It's not very useful. Right. And so it kind of been, we know it polymerizes, but kind of who cares? It doesn't do anything. But this group, they went, okay, we think we can make this better. And what they did was they actually made two slight modifications of this molecule. And then they took their two slightly modified ones in the original. They mixed them all up. They dissolved them in ethanol. And then they added a little bit of water. And out came this polymer. Mm. And it was elastomeric, which means it's stretchy, which, you know, if you're thinking about having
glue,
you know, you want it to kind of stretch, particularly for your organs and stuff.
Or bones, that sort of thing. Yeah.
And then it's also what you call a self-healing adhesive. So it's adhesive, it's a bit sticky. And self-healing, like, it will kind of, if it has a small incision, like a small cut, it will kind of bind back to itself.
Oh, yeah. Because so that's one of the worst things, right? If you have, I know if you get low quality blue tack, right? you might like break it off and then it's like, oh, you can't use this anymore.
Yeah, you know, like, so it's kind of a really super fancy version, right?
Yeah, we've got some very quality blue tack.
And so when they saw these properties, they're thinking, okay, we think this could be used as a tissue adhesive. So, you know, like, we could use it in the body. Mm-hmm. And so what they did was a experiment with the old mice, with the mice, right? And so the amniotic sac, that's the sac that surrounds a fetus, right? And so what they did was this surgery on these mice where they would put a patch of their polymer, they'd stick it to this amniotic sac, and then they were just puncturing it. Like, they were just putting a hole in it and then removing the needle that they used to hold and then suturing up the mouse and letting it go and seeing if the fetus survived or not.
Yeah.
And so if they punctured through their little patch of their polymer, all the fetuses survived. Like, it was a sample size of 5, but they all survived.
Yeah.
And if they didn't use that patch, they all died.
Wow.
So they're kind of saying there's...
Yeah, that's quite... Yeah, compelling evidence. Compelling. Yeah,
so they're definitely it's this thing of it's compelling evidence. And so now they're furthering the research, and then also they're having a startup company to pursue the development of this polymer for these applications, because, you know, like, people, really really skilled surgeons, do actually operate on fetuses, it turns out, for various conditions.
Yeah.
And so if you can obviously have something that's increasing the chances of success of these things, that's always good. And then there's also, because it's a polymer that is adhesive, well, it's pretty good adhesive in the wet or in the dry.
Right.
So then there's stuff like, they're like, oh, you know, we could just use it on adhesive tape or for like your sticky notes, your post-it notes and stuff like this. And so
if you're manufacturing a lot of it, it's multi-purpose.
Yeah, but one of the key issues with this at the moment is what you just said, we're manufacturing a lot of it. So the alpha lipoic acid, at the moment, there's not an industrial large scale sort of process that produces this. But as one of the authors pointed out, decades ago, you could have said the same thing as about styrene. And now, how often do you see polystyrene around the place?
Yeah, it's everywhere, right?
So,
you can't get rid of it.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that's one of the things, like, also with this polymer, is it is coming from a more kind of like a natural source. Like, you could extract it from things, maybe, depending on economics and how well the process works. But also, they're looking at ways that they can break it down if need be, which is obviously
good
one thing that we want.
Yeah, that's good. And then lastly here, we've got green and yellow lasers. I will speak to this just briefly. When we were talking about it earlier today with Johnny, our breakfast host, he was saying he's seen, he says he's seen heaps of green lasers before. So I'm curious, what's going on here?
Yeah, so this is a bit of a strange title, right? So because we have seen lots of green lasers, right? Yeah. We're seeing green laser pointers, they're everywhere. Mm. So I'm kind of going, well, there's new green lasers, what? And you're like, but there has always been.
Yeah.
The thing has been, is there's been this thing we call the green gap. So it's green to yellow lasers. And we have a very few select wavelengths.
Right.
So the green laser pointers you see are at 532 nanometers.
Mm-hmm.
And that the way that we get those is basically you have one wavelength of light is passed through a couple of different types of crystals and it gets converted to 532.
Right.
But it's very specifically 532. And so we have very few specific ones.
Just
and
one type of green.
A bit more than one. Right. We want more. Mm. We always want more.
Just
right?
for fun, right?
Well, there's lots of potential studies and applications with it.
That's
in the future.
Good.
So there are reasons for doing this. The other thing about the green lasers we have at the moment, they're quite hard to miniaturize the way that they're made.
Mm.
And so there's a lot of applications now where we want to miniaturize everything. And so if we want it on small chips, we need to have these ways of making these miniature lasers. And so that's what this research was all about, was kind of filling in this green gap and having this type of laser that you can miniaturize easily. And it's using something called a ring-shaped micro-resonator. So it's basically, you have a material called silicon nitride and you've just made a ring out of it.
Yeah.
And all you do, and make it sound easy, it's not this easy, you pump infrared light into this ring.
Yep.
And so that light is just going to travel around that ring thousands and thousands of times and it's going to gain intensity. And then once it gets to a certain intensity, the light will actually interact with that silicon nitride, that material that the ring's made out of, and you get a process called optical parametric oscillation. Basically what this means is you get two new wavelengths of light produced.
Right.
And so it's this producing these two new wavelengths, one of which we aim for to be in the visible range, the green-yellow range in this case. And that's how we're producing this laser light.
Yeah, okay.
And so what had previously been done is you could just change the dimensions of that micro resonator, so the diameter and that, and you could change the wavelength that was produced. And so they'd gotten 560 nanometers, which is kind of just in the divide between green and yellow, but they only could have a few select wavelengths. So this is this thing of we can only get a few select wavelengths. They wanted more. So what did they do? They made their micro resonator ring a bit thicker. Mm. And so by making it a bit thicker, they could get down into nearer 532 nanometers, but they wanted to do more, and so this silicon nitride ring sits on a layer of silicon dioxide, and so it was just flat against that. And so what they did was they actually undercut removed some of the silicon dioxide, so that the ring is kind of now up on a little bit of a pillar kind of thing, so you could get more air was around the silicon nitride.
Yeah.
And so by doing this, what they actually found was what wavelengths they got out was actually less sensitive to the dimensions of the ring in the wavelength of light they were pumping in, which actually meant that they had better control of what they got out.
Right.
Because, it was less fiddly.
If it's less sensitive. Yeah, that makes sense. Right.
And so now they've managed to get 150 different wavelengths over this green gap.
Yeah.
And so...
Compared to very few.
And also now because of that it's not quite so fully, like they can like fine tune, whereas before like they were kind of taking big steps across the range.
Just approximating that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah, and now they can kind of tune it a lot better.
Hmm.
One problem is they need to, the thing that they've got to work on next is they've got to boost the energy efficiency. Like at the moment for the power you put in, you're only getting a small percentage of power out. So there's still plenty of work to do, but it's quite exciting to see them filling in this gap.
Yeah. And you mentioned, I'm sorry if you don't have these on hand, but you mentioned there's some practical applications for the lasers as well. What's going on there?
So, yeah, so it's stuff like so quantum computing, which is something we've mentioned in the past briefly.
Yeah, we talked about it a little bit.
Yeah, so there's in quantum computing and just quantum technology, there's going to be a lot of use of photonics and stuff, like photonics for the or light for passing the messaging or doing what needs to be done. And so by having lots more of these different wavelengths and having it very well controlled, that kind of opens up applications there.
Different units to communicate in, that sort of thing. Yeah,
and there's other things like you have sensing applications that are based on light. And so if you have very well-controlled specific wavelengths, you can start to do stuff that you possibly couldn't before in sensing, particularly if you can start miniaturizing as well, because you can start making smaller devices, you can start having things more handheld in there. We're a long way away from that, but it's, this is where, you know, this is where the scientists' minds go.
Right. That thing. Yeah, so lots of interesting stuff there. Yeah. Lots of developments in the world of lasers. Turns out even more green than was previously expected.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for coming in today, Kushla. Thank you, Moshat. And thank you, Science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.